here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it can be frustrating to try to learn something new, music or language, just sports, whatever. Author Tom Vanderbilt tells us there's a unique joy that comes along with that kind of discovery. Now, for more than 150 years, Americans have observed Memorial Day, though it's been known under different names along the way. While the name has changed and new wars and conflicts have come along, the intent remains the same, to honor and remember those who have died in service to their country. And Memorial Day has its roots in one of the bloodiest conflicts in our history, the Civil War. In our next conversation, we learn more about the roots of the holiday and what we can learn from that history. Kenneth C. Davis is an author and historian. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Here's our conversation from last Memorial Day. Ken, I know before we dig into the history, I know you want to make a point to the public about, you know, remembering that it's not just any old three-day weekend. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. Look, most of us think about us, except this year, obviously we're in an extraordinary moment in American history. For the most part, when most people think Memorial Day, they're thinking beach, swimsuit sales, or mattress sales, even worse. Look, it's the first weekend of the summer. I get that for most of us. It's a wonderful time, but it really is the most solemn day on the American national calendar. It is a day to honor not just veterans, not just those who served, but specifically those who gave the last full measure of devotion, as Lincoln put it so memorably in the Gettysburg Address. So it is a special holiday that we should understand. It was very divisive and partisan in its roots, and it's changed a lot over 150-odd years, but we must really understand what it's about today.
Well, let's dig back now into the early history. What are some of the earliest examples of people observing Memorial Day, something like Memorial Day, around this time of year?
Well, there were, the idea of going out and making a funeral oration to the dead soldier goes back to the time of Pericles in ancient Athens, one of the most famous speeches in Western civilization. And Lincoln certainly gave that speech in 1863 in Gettysburg, November 1863. During the Civil War, there are instances of people marking the graves of fallen soldiers while the war was still going on. But what we think of as the official beginning of Memorial or Decoration Day, as it was known when I was a kid, was May 30th, 1868. A very prominent American politician, Civil War general named General John Logan, was head of a fraternal organization called the Grand Army of the Republic. He declared that May 30th would be the day that people should go out and strew fresh flowers on the graves of the fallen soldiers. And he was referring specifically to the Union soldiers. This was seen as a Northern holiday. It was a holiday to celebrate the fact that these soldiers had died to save the Union and also to end slavery. That's why many of the Confederate states marked their own separate holiday. And so this became a day that was honored in late 19th century America because of the enormous losses. Of course, 600,000 at least American soldiers died in the Civil War. That number is probably a lot higher. By the way, in Wisconsin, the losses were quite extreme. Wisconsin sent more than 90,000 young men to fight in the South, and more than 12,000 of them never came back.
Yeah, let's detour to Wisconsin a little bit, and a lot of people know Camp Randall as the place to go see the UW Badgers football team play. The history of Camp Randall, though, a lot of some of its most prominent history goes back to the Civil War era. Can you talk about that?
That's right. It was begun as a camp which was meant for training those young men who were going off to war. Obviously, America did not have much of a standing army in 1861 when the war began. Lincoln begins the call for volunteers, and they start to pour in. Camp Randall in Wisconsin was begun as a training camp for the Union Army during the Civil War, and more than 70,000 recruits were trained there. Most interestingly, or in addition to that interest, and especially at this time, there were two things that set Camp Randall apart. First of all, it was there that the former governor's widow, Miss Cordelia Harvey, persuaded President Lincoln to establish hospitals. Very appropriate to be thinking about what healthcare workers do in the time of war and in a time of crisis at this moment. So Cordelia Harvey really gets a page in history on her own. But it was also a prisoner of war camp for Confederate prisoners, and more than 1,000 Confederate soldiers were being held there at one point, and some died, and they were buried at Camp Randall in what is known as the Confederate Rest.
And there was a controversy across the country on both sides about how the other side was treating prisoners of war. And ultimately, I gather the conditions at Camp Randall, even by the Union standards for Confederate captives, wasn't up to par. They ended up moving them to Illinois, I believe.
That's correct. We think of the Civil War, if you have a little bit of knowledge about it, you might have heard of Andersonville, the very notorious camp for Union soldiers in Georgia, which, by the way, after the war, Clara Barton was sent to Andersonville to try and find the missing in action and the missing soldiers there. Rather extra, we think of Clara Barton. Again, this connection of women and nursing in wartime is a very powerful one in the Civil War. Clara Barton begins this mission to find the lost soldiers of Andersonville. But there were Union prisoner of war camps spread across the North. And indeed, they did have standards for how to keep these prisoners. The situation at Camp Randall was a lot of not so much mistreatment or starvation or anything like that, which was the case in Andersonville, but a lot of disease, measles, mumps. These were the killers of the Civil War in large number. In fact, when we talk about the war dead from Wisconsin, that 12,000 number, probably 9,000 of them were people who died, men who died from disease rather than actual battle wounds.
We're talking to historian Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series, talking about the history today of Memorial Day. Ken, let's get back into the early controversy. And this is a controversy in some ways that's lasted to this day. How do we remember the Confederacy? How do we remember soldiers who died on that side and in that cause? Can you talk about some of the early controversy over whether this holiday was meant to be Union side only?
It was clearly Union side only. And if you go back to General Logan's original, it was called an order, even though he was not a general at the time. He was actually in Congress at the time. But the head of this very, very powerful Union organization called the Grand Army of the Republic. And he issued this call for May 30th, 1868, and he said, "We should guard their graves with sacred vigilance. This should be a fitting tribute to the memory of the slain defenders. It's a day to honor those who died in the cause of ending slavery and opposing the rebellion." So it was clearly a partisan Union holiday, and that is why the former Confederate states began their own Confederate Memorial Days or Decoration Days. There's even records of the very first ceremony at Arlington, and for quite a while afterwards, they actually posted guards at Arlington to keep any Confederate families out on this day, because there are Confederate soldiers buried in Arlington, which, by the way, is also a vestige of the Civil War. It is built on land that was confiscated from the family of Robert E. Lee during the war, on the pretense of sorts of not paying taxes, but it was clearly retribution for Lee's leaving the Union, leaving the United States Army, and going to fight with Virginia and lead armies against the United States Army.
I've wondered about the timing, why late May for Memorial Day, and if I have it right, it's because it's a good time to have lots of flowers?
That's it. Was selected apparently because it's the date on which the most flowers are in bloom in the north. Again, a hint that this is a northern holiday, and that was the idea, not just to think about these men, but to actually go to the graveyards and put fresh flowers on the graves, and that is why it was called Decoration Day, to decorate the graves. As time changed, Rob, you know, the Civil War generation got older. Most of them died off, certainly by the turn of the 20th century. This had already become something of a holiday picnic weekend. It was already the weekend where you didn't go to the cemetery anymore necessarily, or you went for a little while, but then you went and had a picnic. But something changed, of course, in 1918, and that is, of course, the United States' involvement in World War I. And it's really the losses in World War I, 102 years ago, ended November 11th, 1918, that revives the idea of Decoration Day or Memorial Day, not just as a Civil War holiday now, but a day to honor all those who died in service to the country, which is how we see it today, of course. And it was at that time that they decided to establish the Tomb of the Unknown at Arlington, which was dedicated in 1921. And the first soldier in that tomb, of course, was from World War I. Later to be added a World War II serviceman, and then a Korean War serviceman. A Vietnam-era serviceman was interred for some time. His body was later identified and later reinterred, I believe, near St. Louis.
We're listening to an encore broadcast about the history of Memorial Day. I talked to author and historian Ken Davis last Memorial Day about the history of the holiday and its roots back in the Civil War. Ken's the author of Don't Know Much About History. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Up next, we'll talk about the role the so-called Spanish flu pandemic played in the First World War. That's coming up next here on Central Time.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas, and thanks.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening to the second half of my conversation with author and historian Kenneth C. Davis about the history of Memorial Day and what we can learn from the holiday. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History. Here's the rest of our conversation. Ken, let's talk about now how Memorial Day changed. You were starting to talk about this in World War I. Now, this, as opposed to the Civil War, this is something that kind of brought the nation together in many ways. Not everybody, of course, approved of World War I, but we, as a country, we're all on the same side here. How did that change the way we approached Decoration Day or Memorial Day?
Well, it did take it from this somewhat divisive partisan sense of a holiday and into a truly national holiday, because now the United States, of course, there had been other military engagements in between the Civil War and World War I, the most significantly the Spanish-American War, which was fairly short-lived and not a tremendous loss of lives. But with World War I, you have the loss of more than 100,000 American soldiers die in World War I, but that was in a very short period of time. The troops land in May of 1918. About a million American soldiers land in May of 1918. The war is over in November of 1918. About 100,000 men die in that period. And, of course, many of them died from the Spanish flu, because the two things were completely connected. So there was a new sense of seeing this holiday as an opportunity, a possibility to remember all of America's losses in all of its wars. And that's when, as I said, it was determined that they should build the monument to the unknown soldier, a tradition that had existed in Europe long before then.
And the poppy flower is often associated with dead service members, the people who died in the line of duty. And this is around the time that happens during World War One.
That's right. It's also another World War One tradition that comes out of a poem that was written in 1915. Remember, the war starts in August 1914. The United States is not involved in it. A poem is written in 1915 by a young Canadian surgeon. His name just escaped me, but the poem is called In Flanders Fields. And it begins, "In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row by row." It became internationally famous in the English-speaking world, of course. And a young American woman saw the poppy, the symbol of loss, of sacrifice, of death, of remembrance. She started to sell poppies to raise money for soldiers, widows, and orphans. And that was the beginning of what was called the poppy movement. It is as big and maybe bigger in Great Britain. Perhaps you saw at the 100th anniversary of the end of the war in 2018, there were poppies covering, you know, buildings in London and in France as well. So this is a very powerful symbol. I remember being a kid around this time of year, being in school. The veterans would come into our classroom and sell those little paper poppies to us. And, you know, you wanted to plunk down your quarter and buy a poppy from those veterans. It was a very, very meaningful thing. I don't know what the poppy movement is like this year. We can't really be out selling things on the street hand to hand, but it's still a powerful symbol of what war and loss really mean.
Oh, and our producers passed along the name John McCrae, the author of
John
In Flanders
McCrae,
Field.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, JC, for passing that along. And now talk about how we've institutionalized, Ken, Memorial Day since then. As you said, you grew up celebrating it as Decoration Day still.
That's right. And, you know, when I was a kid, it was a really important holiday for us in my small town, as it is in many small towns. Partly because Memorial Day fell during the school year. So it was a school day off, but we didn't actually have a day off. It was the day that all the schools would march and participate in the town's parade. It was really much more important, much more significant in many ways than the 4th of July, which happened in the summertime when school was out. So this was, to me, and my father was a World War II veteran. Most of my uncles and other relatives had served in World War II. So this was a very powerful holiday for me growing up. The big change institutionally was that it became a national holiday in the 1960s. Before then, it was really up to governors to proclaim Memorial Day. In 1968, it becomes a national holiday. It's ultimately moved from the traditional May 30th date to the third Monday in May, and that is where it is today. The other big difference that I have to point out here is that the Vietnam War changed a lot of people's attitudes towards Memorial Day. During the 60s, Memorial Day, because the war was so unpopular, we had a different approach to thinking about it at the time. We couldn't disconnect the service of the soldiers from the unpopularity of the war. So Memorial Day fell into not disrepair or disrepute. It just didn't have the same resonance for a period during Vietnam than it did later. And it took a long time to get past that. I think it's only with the opening of the extraordinary Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., designed by Maya Lin, that we get some closure on that period. And those young men and women who went off to Vietnam and were not welcomed for their service when they came back finally felt that they were getting their appropriate recognition for what they had done.
I want to take our last minute, Ken, to ask you, you've mentioned the Spanish flu. You had a so-called Spanish flu. You had a book about the history there and how it intersected with the First World War. Just take a minute. Any lessons or thoughts you have looking back just over a century at that epidemic to today?
Very powerful lessons and very perfect example of why history matters. The first lesson is the most important, perhaps. Spanish flu started in the spring. It came back worse in September. We have to keep that in mind right now. We cannot think that this thing is over in the next few months. The second thing is that it was really driven by propaganda, lies, and censorship early on in 1918. That's a very dangerous combination. We've seen that today as well. And two more quick points related. We can't ignore science. It's lethal to ignore science. They did in 1918. In Philadelphia, the warnings were don't have a parade to sell Liberty loans. They went ahead and did it. 200,000 people in the street. 2 days later, every hospital bed in Philadelphia was filled. And finally, the last point is misplaced priorities. Many cities, like Philadelphia, thought the war effort was more important than the public health. And that was one of the reasons that the Spanish flu was so deadly.
That was Kenneth C. Davis. He's a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. We revisited our conversation with Ken from last Memorial Day. Coming up after the news, when's the last time you learned something completely new? We'll listen back to our conversation with author Tom Vanderbilt about his new book about the joy of being a beginner, especially for grown-ups. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, it's a great time of year to go fishing. Larry and his guests tell us about the joy of getting out in the stream and fly fishing. That's tomorrow morning on The Larry Mueller Show at 11 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when's the last time you learned a new skill for the first time? Drawing, an instrument, a sport, or maybe a craft? Once we leave childhood, we tend to leave behind the regular practice of trying to learn new stuff. The author of a new book explores the experience of being a beginner in all kinds of skills, surfing, drawing, singing, and chess, for example, and how it can keep us more engaged in other facets of our lives. Tom Vanderbilt writes on design, technology, science, and culture, and is the author of several books. His latest is called Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. I talked to Tom back in February. Here's our conversation. You write that you're inspired in part by being a new parent, and even more so when your daughter and then you started taking on a chess. Talk about how that experience inspired your quest to learn how and why grownups can learn.
Sure. My daughter was 4 at the time when she asked if we could play a game of chess. And this was sort of embarrassing for me, but I actually didn't know how. And I tried to learn the game myself to pick it up, but it's a pretty complex game. So I felt a little bit over my head. Ended up hiring a coach. This coach came over to give my daughter some lessons. And I figured, what, I'd like to learn this as well. Why should I just sort of sit on the sidelines? And this was a pattern in my life where I was taking my daughter, who had this, like all children do, this real hunger for learning. I was taking her to all these lessons and then just sort of sitting on my phone usually nearby. And I thought, you know what? What's the last new skill I learned? I'm going to plunge in and do some of the things she's doing as well as some other things. And that was sort of the idea.
And you learned something there that keeps coming up through your book. Kids learn things one way, and it seems like they're really good at it in their way. Adults learn things, it seems like, in a different way. What is it about being a grown-up that makes that new thing different than it is for that 4-year-old, say?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sort of broad categories here. There's the brain stuff, which, kids just have these brains that are really optimized for learning, and they have these synapses that are sort of being connected and just a real hunger. And they have a very quick, what's called fluid intelligence. Adults, we've I was in my 40s. I had 4 decades of already learning a bunch of other stuff, which was sort of sitting in my brain like an old crowded hard drive on your computer. So for me to learn something new, I've got to get past all that other stuff. And if I go to learn a new language, well, maybe it sounds a little bit like another language I learned, or maybe my English grammar gets in the way of my Spanish grammar. But so the brain is one thing, but there's the whole lifestyle question as well. I mean, children, number one, very young children, most of the things they're learning are very important to them to learn. They're learning how to walk, to talk, to get along with other people. Adults, when we learn, it tends to be, sort of a more recreational thing, sort of hobbies. That's not necessarily survival at stake. But the other key thing there is pressure and fear. Kids, just plunge in. They really don't know much pressure or fear. Adults, overthink things. We worry about looking bad in front of other people. So it's hard.
Let's talk a little bit about the why. If I pick up, and I have been trying to pick up new things. If I pick up something new at this stage in my life, I know I'm never going to be a star, an expert. It's not going to be my, I'm not going to make money doing it. So why do I want to learn a new thing in the first place, Tom?
Yeah, I think we've all been sort of, corrupted or whatever the word is by this 10,000 hours rule that people have probably heard about, which was from the sociologist Anders Ericsson, talking about how much practice you needed to become an expert level performer. Of course, most of us don't have, 100 hours to try to tackle something. But the good news is we don't need to be expert level performers. So I would argue that, in 10 hours, the amount of time you might spend watching, binging a Netflix show, you could actually pick up some fairly decent skills in something like drawing. The great thing about the learning curve is that it's steep, which means at the beginning, you're making a lot of progress. There will be plateaus later, but that's sort of the great thing about learning, and what makes it so addictive in a way about being a beginner is that just that sort of excitement and thrill at the beginning, you're learning something new. And I would argue that you're really changing your self-identity a little bit. You're sort of expanding the notion of who you are. And then you can add these things to your sort of life resume, as it's been called, like I'm so-and-so, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a singer. It took me a while to feel comfortable calling myself a singer, but I'll own it now.
One interesting thing you did was surfing, not a community, you write, that's necessarily known for being welcoming to the newcomer. But one thing you learned there and took as a lesson, and this is generally true, you can make some early progress, but there's often a point you hit where you get worse, or at least it feels like you get worse. It's the U-shaped learning curve. What is that, and how can we keep going past it?
Yeah, progress is not always linear. If you're learning to do something like surf, one day you'll go to the ocean, to the surf break. Feels like you've got it dialed in. You're hitting all of these waves. The next day, maybe the conditions change just a little bit. Something is off. You're still learning, and you catch zero waves. And there's various reasons for that, but often what's happening is you're approaching some sort of plateau, and when it hurts, when your brain hurts, that's when you're learning. The sad thing here is that, when it feels good, that's when you've learned it. And that's a very nice feeling to have as an adult, to feel competent in something, but that means the learning has stopped. So if you're going to go after that next goal, it's going to have to hurt again. And that again is something that, humans quite naturally try to avoid when possible, is having things frustrate them. But that is when learning is actually happening.
Tom, you mentioned becoming a singer, and you hadn't been someone who people thought of as a singer. You went and you looked for a singing group that was, easy enough for you to get into, but hard enough and good enough to present a challenge to you. Why was that the level you were shooting for?
Yeah, psychologists call that desirable difficulty, where, you're pushed just a little bit beyond the edge of your comfort zone. And, I had been taking these private vocal lessons, which were fun, and I was making a lot of progress, but it also felt a little bit sterile. I was, sort of like, imagine, doing soccer drills in a gym day after day, like kicking the ball against the wall. I wanted to get out and sort of be in a real environment, like a game. So, a choir to me seemed the safe zone where I could be out in public performing, but have 50 or 60 people around me. So it wasn't, no solos involved here. But but again, that's the great thing about learning in a class or a group with people. There were people of varying skill sets around me. I could draw upon their experience. After I was there a little while, suddenly I had a little bit of experience. I could sort of tell when a new person had joined the choir and they had that deer in the headlights sort of look. And then I became, you know, let's say a small scale expert, but that's sort of, there's sort of a magic sweet spot that happens with people learning new things together. It's called a community of practice. And you know, we can use each other as a resource, not just the teacher.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Milwaukee. Dan, hello.
Hello. Let me start off by saying my motto is everything is easy. All you have to do is try. And for the pandemic, I remodeled a bathroom, made a Volkswagen trike, built it out of a car, and got into EDM music composition with drum machines and synthesizers and all that. So,
well, let's take that musical composition, Dan. Had you done something like that before?
No. I actually have no rhythm whatsoever. That's why I had to do it electronically.
I love it. Dan, thank you so much for sharing that. So, I don't know. Dan thinks everything's easy if you try it. There's still some challenges along the way, though, Tom, but I do like that attitude.
Yeah, and sometimes these things are sort of, you know, placed upon us from the outside. I mean, what he was saying about remodeling his bathroom, I've just moved into a house. I've been living in an apartment for many years where the super took care of things. Suddenly I'm in this house. I'm kind of a beginner in owning a house. So, you know, all these home maintenance things that a lot of people take for granted, they're like very new to me. And I've already been making, you know, some stupid mistakes, but I'm trying.
Now, and Dan also mentioned he's doing this stuff during the pandemic. You started this book, this project, at least, Tom, pre-pandemic. Do you see people taking on this idea of, hey, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to try something new?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the pandemic, one thing about it is that it really turned us all into beginners of a sort. I mean, no one really was that cognizant in Zoom or remote schooling via computer for elementary school children. I mean, they're all wearing a mask. There were all these things we had to sort of fit into our daily life that were new and prevent, you know, it was a little bit unsettling. And after a little while, we got the drill. But you're right. So that sense of disruption, people, you know, didn't have their normal commute to work. They had a little extra time, or they weren't able to do the things they normally did. Open this huge window, and you basically look at all these metrics, like websites like Duolingo, the language app, or sales of guitars and guitar lesson sites, or chess learning websites have all absolutely exploded during the pandemic. If you're a gardener, you can't order seeds right now. I mean, there's just, we've sort of had, you know, we're hitting peak hobby, I think, which I think is great news, but it's definitely at a different place than I was a few years ago when I started the book.
We are re-listening to our conversation with Tom Vanderbilt about his book, Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. He's a journalist who writes about design, technology, science, and culture. I talked with him back in February. Coming up, we find out how we can try new things without being self-conscious about not being as good as we want to be. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we are revisiting our conversation with author Tom Vanderbilt about his book, Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. I talked to Tom back in February. To kick off the next part of our conversation, we hear about one listener's experience learning a new instrument at a later age. Here's what he had to say. Oh, we got an email from Pete in Reedsburg. Pete says he took up guitar at age 66. Guitar for the first time. He's working on a YouTube channel. He says, the nice thing about trying new things when you're old is that not only do you not care what others think of you, you've had time to figure out they were never thinking of you at all. Thanks for sending that in, Pete. And that's a thing for me, Tom, overcoming the self-consciousness. I've been trying to learn Spanish on one of those free language apps and some other ways. Long streak going. Great. I know the thing I need to do is find places where I have to speak to people in Spanish, and I'm just scared. I get paid to talk for a living, and the idea of, you know, talking worse than a little kid could talk, I don't know, it fills me with anxiety. How do we overcome, as Pete has, that self-consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. You know, we spend our adult lives trying to project an image of competence. You know, you're working on your job, your career, your resume. You don't highlight the things you're not that good at on your resume. So to suddenly go out there in public and be sort of bad at something, you know, but he's right. You know, that there is this, on the other hand, there's this thing called imposter syndrome, where sometimes even in our jobs, we're sort of thinking, are we really that qualified? But that's what's sort of so liberating about plunging into something, especially with a class of other beginners. So then you're kind of all at you know, square one, that you're not worried about imposter syndrome because no one actually expects you to be any good. And I think a lot of that, I think, comes with age definitely helps, I think, put a little bit of that stuff in the rearview mirror and you lose that fear. But yeah, so I still suffer for it myself. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's not something that you can do away with, I think.
Let's go back to our callers. Sandy is with us in Mauston. Sandy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you learned, Sandy?
Well, I tell you, I'm a retired teacher. I used to do substitute teaching until COVID, and I had to do something. So I watched a lot of tutorials, and I'm learning to paint.
Cool. How's
and
it going?
I'm absolutely loving it.
Uh-huh. And do you feel like you're picking it up pretty quick, Sandy?
I feel like I am, yes. There are communities on Facebook where you can post your pictures, your paintings, and you get feedback. And, yeah, I found out I can actually paint, and I'm even learning to draw.
Fantastic. I'm glad to hear that, Sandy. And I like that, Tom, that she's joined a community and they're, you know, they offer advice and hopefully positive, constructive feedback. But again, that idea of having a community of people you're learning with seems like a big boost for this, as you discovered, Tom.
Absolutely. I mean, the motivation, the sense of sort of responsibility of getting feedback. And it sounds like also that she is taking classes online, which is something that, you know, when I was working on my book, because I wanted to, you know, get out and meet people and hear their stories, I was doing all in-person classes. And then, of course, when COVID happened, all of this stuff shifted online. I was a bit skeptical in the beginning, but I've taken online drawing courses. And in some ways, there's things you can do with technology online that are as good as, or in some ways, even better than in person. So I think that's really that sort of revolution. And there's a lot of stuff that's available for free or not that expensive, you know, classes, videos, you can hire coaches all around the world, has really, again, made this sort of a golden age of learning, I think.
Thanks a lot for the call, Sandy. Keep it up for sure. We'll go to Ted now in Spooner. Ted, hello.
Yeah, hello.
What are you doing, Ted, or what have you done?
Well, when I was 65, I tried downhill or snowboarding, downhill skiing, but it switched over to snowboard. Well, that was a challenge. But I can say one thing. The younger people thought it was really cool that I was trying, and they stopped by and gave me hints left and right on how to do it.
All right. Did you keep it up, Ted, or was it a one-off like my downhill skiing experience was?
Well, I'd done it for 4 or 5 years, but now I had a total knee replacement, and the other knee is about ready to go. I don't think I should try it again.
That seems very reasonable. Ted, thank you for sharing that. That was one of the things, Tom, that you and I think your daughter, again, tried together.
Yeah, I'm not much of a skier, and I was not a snowboarder at all. But, you know, again, just I thought, okay, let's try it. And, you know, I sort of had this magic transformation of, and this is what I'm trying to, you know, urging people. I mean, just after one day, I had become basically a snowboarder. I'm not saying I was good at all, but I had ridden on a snowboard down a hill, I think, which I think qualifies as a snowboarder. And this had not been in my life at all. And I mean, the caller raised a couple other interesting things. You know, there's this thing about one thing that's when learning a new skill, one frustrating thing is that the skills often don't transfer as well as we think they might. You'd think snowboarding and skiing are pretty identical, but there's a lot of different things there. And it can be hard, you know, the longer you've been doing one sport to sort of switch over. And they do say snowboarding is easier to in the beginning and then harder to master. And it's the opposite with skiing. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but kudos to Ted for, you know, not letting age get in the way. And I'm 52 now, but I've had experiences of doing things like playing video games, online video games with my daughter, Fortnite squads. And I get kudos from her 9-year-old friends. I'm not sure what that's worth, but, you know, again, it's about sort of looking forward and not thinking you're ever too old or anything's inappropriate for you to learn, you know, at any age.
Now, can you talk about getting through the moments of frustration, that U-shaped curve we talked about earlier where I thought I was getting good and now I'm getting worse or at best plateauing? How do we power through that to get to the good side again?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you just really have to walk away. I mean, rest. I mean, and there's, you know, sometimes taking a week off and your brain sort of works on the puzzles that you had in your head without even knowing it subconsciously and sort of sorts it out almost magically, I would say. And there's coaches have all sorts of tricks as well too. I mean, just in terms of learning juggling, for example, I would sometimes be struggling and I seemed like I had it. Then I suddenly couldn't get it. I almost, you know, had the equivalent of writer's block, but for juggling, I just couldn't juggle. So they would say, well, you know, change the room you're doing it in, change the backdrop you're throwing the balls against, change the hand you throw the ball with first, change the objects you're throwing. Basically, just change is good. It sort of like sparks the brain into thinking, approaching a problem from a new angle, which is really, you know, another thing that learning really is. It's just finding new solutions to new problems as they arise. If you do one drill too much, you sort of like over practice something, and it's really diminishing returns because it will only help solve one problem, or something like snowboarding. A lot of different things can happen. So you need to be very flexible. And this is something that another thing that really distinguishes infant and child learners is that kind of flexibility. They learn a lot through playful exploration, which includes a lot of mistakes as well.
In our last few moments, Tom, you've learned singing, surfing, juggling, chess, Fortnite, you just mentioned. Do you have your eye on your next learning project?
Well, my daughter just joined a mountain biking club, so I have on order a mountain bike. It's coming to me, but because of COVID, there's a huge demand for these sorts of things. So it's been a little bit delayed, but I expect to be out on the hills pretty soon.
All right. Well, best of luck to you on that. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was my conversation with Tom Vanderbilt. He writes about design, technology, science, and culture, and is the author of several books. His latest is called Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. We talked to him in February. And the conversation continued later online. We heard from Dave, who commented on WPR.org. He wrote, I achieved a long-time goal by obtaining my private pilot license at age 60. It was a challenge to sit down and book learn again. The online resources and videos were a great help, especially the practice testing. Took me 2 attempts at age 16, but I managed to pass the written on the first attempt at 60. Well, congratulations, Dave, for getting that pilot's license. Coming up later this week on Central Time, we'll have our weekly check-in on all the latest political news at the nation's capital with The Week in Washington on Wednesday. And allergy sufferers, we're not out of the woods yet when it comes to pollen. We'll learn more about the peak season for pollen. And check out Food Friday for some tasty advice. That's coming up Friday all this week here on Central Time. Earlier this month, we took a look at the history of museums around the world, and we asked you to join in with your favorite museums, big or small, in Wisconsin or beyond. You shared a lot of great recommendations from the Hamilton Woodtype Museum in Two Rivers to a logic puzzle museum in Burlington. And we heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kate recommends the Peshtigo Fire Museum with stories of the devastating fire of 1871. Pete says Waukesha County Museum. My mother, Pete writes, was the first female director there. Starting back in the 70s, she took it from a small, relatively unknown museum to one that received national recognition. I grew up there, Pete says, sliding down brass railings and talking to the wonderful staff, and met Les Paul. I got to talk to him several times. They were good friends, Les Paul and Pete's mom. And Jennifer recommends the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. We had a caller rave about that one, too. I need to check it out at some point. Are you planning a museum visit this summer, or did you go to one this weekend? Tell us about it. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.